Nice to be with you.
Shall we open our Bibles, please, in the book of 1 Kings? 1 Kings and chapter 19. The first book of Kings and chapter number 19, verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die, and said, It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, Arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baked on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did eat and drink, and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the mount of God. And he came thither unto a cave, and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said unto him, What doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I, only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And he said, Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by. And a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire, and after the fire, a still, small voice. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle, and went out, and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him, and said, What doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I, only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And the Lord said unto him, Go, return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet have I left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. And we do look to God to give help tonight. I wanted to think with you tonight about Elijah's long journey back to God. It took over 40 days for Elijah to get back to where God wanted Elijah to be. At least 40 days in the wilderness. It reminds you, does it not, of the 40 years that the nation of Israel spent in the wilderness, that they might be where God wanted them to be too. And so we follow tonight this man's journey. It's a wilderness journey. It's a wilderness period in his life. It's a time of deep discouragement. It's a time of despair. It's a time of sorrow and a time of sadness And maybe as we look at it, it is a time of perplexity, and we wonder why it should ever be. For we remember that wilderness journey and that time of despair that we've just read of in the life of Elijah, it lies under the shadow of a great mountain. It lies under the shadow of Carmel. The high point, you would think, of that man's spiritual experience, where 450 prophets of Baal were taken and were slain. An experience when he saw the fire of God coming down from heaven and consuming the sacrifice that he had put upon the altar. What an experience it was for Elijah. His prayers answered in a dramatic way. His name lifted up before everyone that was there that day. No longer could anyone ever doubt that he spoke the very words that God himself had given. No longer would anyone doubt that he spoke as the oracles of God. What a high point of his experience. And yet despite that, we have a time of sadness and sorrow and discouragement, a wilderness journey. It's all in the shadow of that great Mount Carmel. And Carmel, as you might know, means fruitfulness. You might be able to work that out from the stickers that the nation of Israel put on their fruit. Everything is marked Carmel. Fruitfulness. And he comes from the Mount of Fruitfulness, and he's going to go on a journey. But maybe you'll remember this in case I don't remember to say it later on. That sometimes when we look at our life, and we see that wilderness time and that time of doubt and that time of despair, even a time that in the life of Elijah is marked by death in a sense. You'll remember this, that not only is that time lived out under the shadow of the good times that are past, but you'll remember that those wilderness experiences lie not in the shadow of one mountain, but they lie between two mountains. And in this experience of the wilderness that Elijah knew, God was taking him from where he was to where he had to be. And it's so hard for us to see that at times. And we think at times we've made it and we've done it and we've been there. And he came from this great place, this place where he was something before men. And God would take him to a place where he was nothing before God. He was there at a place where he saw something of the mighty power of the great God of Israel. Until God eventually would take him to that place where he did not see the power of God, but rather he felt and he knew the presence of God. He was a rich experience in the life of Elijah. Taken from that point where before men he was everything, to be before God nothing. There, from that point where he was given honour amongst men, to a point where he was brought to total honesty with his God. What an experience in the life of Elijah. I want you to think about that journey, and I want to just map it out for you geographically. Well, maybe not so much geographically, but maybe more spiritually. And it struck me that there were four places that were significant in this journey of Elijah. The first was a place of power. That was Mount Carmel. And then there was a second place. It's there in chapter 19, verse 3. Beersheba, the well of the oath. And I want to think about the place of the promise. So we start at the place of power. There's no doubt about that. That was a mighty place of power, fire from heaven, everything that the charismatic movement today could ever hope for and more, but the strange thing was it never satisfied. Very interesting that, isn't it? And there is that great place of power. And then he goes to a place of the promise, Beersheba. And then he's in the wilderness for 40 days and we find him under that strange tree, the juniper tree in verse number 4, and I want to think a little bit about that as a place of preparation. And then finally, he reaches Horeb. And Horeb and Sinai are two words that are very difficult to distinguish. Some people say Sinai was part of Horeb, and some geographers say that Horeb was part of Sinai. But it doesn't really matter. We're just going to regard them as synonymous with one another. Maybe you can tell me more about that later. But we have these four places then, a place of power, and then a place of the promise, and then a place of preparation, and then finally God takes him to that place where he needs to be, the place of the presence of God, the still small voice. Now, as I read about those four places, and as I followed the journey of Elijah through those four places, I discovered that Elijah made some startling discoveries in those places. Some startling discoveries. Discoveries that in many ways turn my theology upside down. Discoveries that in many ways turn my thinking upside down, that revolutionise the way that I think about God and think about his purposes for me. For example, in the first place there, that place of power, Elijah makes a startling discovery, and you'll pause for 10 or 15 minutes until you give me the opportunity to explain it, but his startling discovery is this, that the power of God isn't enough. It's not enough. What a startling discovery. He sees everything that he prays for, the power of God poured out in fire and in judgment, and yet it's not enough. It's not enough for an unbelieving king and queen, it's not enough for an unbelieving nation, and it's not even enough for an unsettled prophet, for it's not too long before it all seems forgotten about him, and he's back to worse than where he was. He discovers that the power of God sometimes is not enough. And then he discovers, secondly, at that place of Beersheba, that there are times when we must go beyond the promises of God. And I'll explain that. I'm not coming with some strange Ayrshire theology that you've never heard of before, but I'm just wanting to use a few phrases that maybe will help us to think about them. A power that is not enough. And then a place where he had to go beyond the promises of God. And then thirdly, he discovered that at times, before we might live for God, we have to die. What a strange truth. But that truth you know all about. You know all about that truth. And if you've ever preached the gospel, you've preached that truth. That before I might live, I must die. And you've preached the same truth, that before I might live, Christ might die, must die. And before I might live for him, my old life must die. Well, this New Testament truth Elijah discovers. There's no new Testament truth, is there? It's all the one tremendous revelation of God, the same God in the Old and the New Testament. Well, what a strange truth. You can imagine the perplexity of it. What a strange truth to discover that before I must live, I must die. And then fourthly, he discovers at Horeb that the great God of Israel, who spoke by fire and by flame, and who spoke in the lightning, and who spoke in the thunder, something that the nation of Israel were very familiar with. The same great God of Israel who spoke in the thunder, the lightning, the flame and the fire, also speaks in a still, small voice. And I want to suggest to you that out of all of those things he discovers, that was the most startling for Elijah. For it was what he needed. And it was where God wanted to bring him. And I noticed it a while ago as I read it, but you'll notice that there was only one place he could hear it. He could never have heard that still small voice on the top of Mount Carmel. It was a racket. 450 prophets of Baal meeting a fool of themselves. And shouting and calling down the powers of Baal. He was an Ayrshire god, actually. His name's still around in Tar Baelton. Yeah, there was an altar to Baal in Ayrshire, so maybe some of the things remind us. You would never have heard it there, though. On the top of Mount Carmel, the still, small voice of God. But he would hear it there on the top of Mount Horeb, not only in the top of Mount Horeb, but you see how precise the word of God is. He's taken to Mount Horeb, and in verse 9 he goes into a cave, not only in the quietness of the mountain, but in the echo of the cave, where everything has its own special amplification, just to hear the still small voice of God. Remember then that Elijah's wilderness experience lies between these two places. Not just in the shadow of the power and the shadow of the experience of Carmel, but it lies between Carmel and Horeb. because it's to Horeb that God would take him, that he might hear in Horeb what he never heard and could never hear in Mount Carmel. Well, let's think for a moment or two about some of these places where he went. And you notice the first thing, we haven't read about it, but it's there in chapter 18, and we just want to mention it, really. It was the place of power. And I made a statement that needs a little explanation so that you might just see where I'm coming from. And in verse number 1, and later on, I want to suggest to you that one of the great lessons that Elijah learns, and it's a lesson that you and I must learn, is that sometimes the experience of God that we want is not the experience of God that we need. And sometimes what we desire from God is not what God will give us, because it's the last thing in the world that is good for us. And there you see in 1 Kings 18, God has given what so many of us would love to see. We would love to see a pouring out of the power of God in our day. And may we see it, may we see it. And God hasn't changed. I don't believe that God has changed. And I don't believe that we cannot see an outpouring of God's power. But the point I want to make here in 1 Kings 18 and 19 is that if you think that you can just pray that the power of God would be seen in your village or your town, and that what you really need is the power of God before men, and that many people will be converted and come to Christ, you're going to be bitterly disappointed. Because the manifestation, the evidence of the power of God there on Mount Carmel was not enough. It was not enough to convert the unbelieving hearts. You'll see here in verse 1 in 1 Kings 19, a strange, bizarre statement. Verse number 1 and 2, I should say verse 2. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, so let the gods do to me and more also, if I may make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. What gods? What gods is she talking about? The gods whose 450 prophets have just been slain on Mount Carmel and their blood poured into the Kishon, the brook Kishon. Those gods. Yeah, those gods. In other words, a mighty demonstration of the power of God has not changed her unbelieving heart. Somebody has well said, I think it was Rabbi Zacharias in his little book on Hinduism and Christianity, he said that more evidence just gives an unbelieving heart more to reject. It's true, isn't it? How far we've come in science in the last 30 years. I think I mentioned it before in here, but if I was to take Willie here and put him in a liquidizer, he wouldn't mind. He's a game for anything. I remember him for the Sunday school trip. Should remember the Sunday school trip. Well, if I was to take Willie and put him in a liquidizer and extract all of the information out of that liquidizer that encodes a Willie Clark, do you know how much information there would be in a Willie Clark? Now, no snide comments about enough to write in the back of a matchbox or anything. But if we started unravelling the information in a Willie Clark, say, from Kitman Hill, I would be unravelling it at Straven as I drove home. I would be unravelling it at New Cumnock. I would be unravelling it way past New Cumnock. I would have to head south to Dumfries. I'd still be unravelling it at London. I would go across the Channel Tunnel. In fact, to cut a long story short, there's enough information in you and I in the form of DNA to unravel between the Earth and the Sun and back 100 times. The man that discovered the structure of DNA said there was nothing more startling to his atheism. But he died an atheist. Why? Wouldn't he believe it? Wouldn't he believe it? They still say that maybe it fell from outer space. Maybe it fell from outer space. Maybe E.T. did it. The point is, the more evidence I have, unless something happens to my heart, it just gives me more to reject and more for my heart to be hardened against. And the demonstration of the power of God was not enough to change an unbelieving heart, and you'll find as well that it wasn't really what Elijah needed, actually. Because having seen all that he saw and having experienced all that he experienced, he still hit the biggest episode of depression and discouragement and dishearteningness that he had never ever known in his life. Sometimes we think that we need another experience, or we need to see God doing something out there,
But the reality is, our first and greatest need is for God to do something in here.
That place of Carmel, he sees something of the power of God. God's going to take him on a journey, and he'll take him via three other places. He'll take him via the place of the promise in verse 3 and the place of preparation in the wilderness until he takes him to the place of his presence. Verse number 3, and when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. A place of a promise. I was looking at some of the sheets that came in for registration in the practice last week, and I think I must be getting old or something, because I remarked to the practice manager that it used to be the case you would look at names and you weren't sure if it was a boy or a girl. But now you look at names and you're no sure if it's a person or a place, you know. How do you spell Georgia? Is that a girl or is it somewhere in America? We had an argument about it. The names that we give people at times are meaningless. Times are quite strange. But when God chooses a name for a place, it always has significance. And Beersheba is one of these places that has a name with great significance. It is the well of the oath. And not only do you find that when God gives a place a name, it has significance, but every so often you find a place or a person. And not only does their name have significance, but it has a real flavour of destiny about it. And Beersheba was a bit like that. For the man who named it Beersheba, Abraham, he had just made an oath there. And he had made promises to a man called Abimelech. And because he made a promise at the well, he called the place Beersheba, the well of the oath. But you know, even before he called it the well of the oath, God had already made an oath there at that well to somebody else. God had made an oath to a woman by the name of Hagar about her son. And if you don't believe that oath, you can open up your newspaper and you'll see that he kept his word. But that was a place of the oath, and you follow it through, and it seems to always be linked with this idea of oath, because Isaac has his promise from God reaffirmed to him at that same place, and you'll find Jacob has a promise from Isaac made at that same place. So it's always linked with the idea of a promise and an oath. But what I noticed here, you know, was that as God would take Elijah on this long journey back to God, he would take him via this place of Beersheba, the place of the promise. And I noticed this too, you know, in verses 3 and 4, that not only did God take him to the place of the promise, but I think this, that God took him beyond the place of the promise. He takes him to Beersheba, verse number 3, which belongeth to Judah, and it says he left his servant there, but he himself went a day's journey. He goes beyond the promise. So what do you mean now, Stuart? I mean, for God really to bring Elijah to where God wants Elijah to be, he has to take him beyond the promises of God. You say, what do you mean by that? I mean, all great men of the Bible, all great men of faith in the Bible did this. They all went beyond the promises of God. In other words, God gave them a promise. For example, Abraham. God said to Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. He said that to Abraham when he was down in Iraq, out of the Chaldees. But Abraham didn't just sit back and say, oh, that's good. I know the text. I know the tense, I know the teaching now. I'll stay in the Chaldees, put my feet up beside the fire. No. He understood the text, he understood the tense, he understood the teaching, and so he laid hold of it, didn't he? He went beyond it. He went beyond just receiving the text and the tense and the terms of God's promise. He actually trusted the God that made the promise, and he went on to receive the promise. See what I mean? What about Joshua? Do you remember that there in Joshua chapter number 1 that God made Joshua a mighty promise? He promised that he would be with Joshua. He would strengthen Joshua. That the Lord God would be with Joshua and he would give him that inheritance that he desired. Joshua didn't stay on the other side of the Jordan and just wait for it to fall in his lap, did he? No. He believed God. He heard the text. He knew the tense. He knew the terms. And so he went forward. He went forward. And he actually received what he believed. What about Gideon? The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. He could well have doubted it. And he got a bit mixed up with what the angel said, I think. Because he said to the angel, do you remember, if the Lord be with us, how are all these things befallen us? But the angel didn't say the Lord was with them. The angel said the Lord was with him. And the angel wasn't he. The Lord was not with the nation in the same way that he was with Gideon. He got his personal pronouns mixed up. Easy done, isn't it? But anyway, Gideon heard that the Lord is with thee. He didn't stay there, fresh and wheat. He went forward to the Midianites, didn't he? Because he knew the text, he knew the tense, he could argue about the meaning. He could tell us about the doctrine, he could take a meeting, no problem. But he would actually put it into practice. That was the difference, wasn't it? That's what I mean. That's what I mean. Going beyond the promises of God. Going beyond a theoretical Christianity. Going beyond just a Bible reading knowledge of things. Going beyond a Saturday night meeting. Going beyond just a veneer of outward Christianity. Going beyond just a routine. Going beyond just a knowledge of how to do it and a repetitive doing of it. But actually believing it and trusting it and believing that the God of the universe is my God. Resting in them. Have you done that? Or can you just tell me all about them? When I arrived in New Cumlock 7 years ago, I looked very young, apparently. Also with two children. Things change. And I was responsible to do all the cutting out things. And New Cumlock people are a bit like Kirkmuir Hill people. They're very down to earth and they tell you what they think. And I started cutting out things and folks would ask me the same question. They would look at me and I must have looked quite young and they would say, have you ever done this before, son? Eventually I worked out an answer and my answer was, well, I've read about it in a book. Most of them stayed. Sometimes I wonder if our Christianity can be a bit like that. Have you done it before? No, I've read about it in a book. And we know the tense and we know the teaching and we know the promises, but have we ever actually grasped them and trusted them? Have we actually did what the Lord tells us, not just in general kind of vague ways like keeping out of bother with the police, but have we actually done what the Lord has told us to do with our life and trusted him even when it seems that it's the wrong thing to do? Well, I think you know that God would take Elijah to that very place beyond the promise, resting in God. Verse 4, he went himself, he himself went a day's journey. You do know that not everybody went beyond the promises of God, because his servant stayed there, didn't he, at Beersheba in verse 3. But verse 4, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die, and said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my father. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baked in the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. A place of preparation. And you see that he goes into the wilderness there for 40 days, 40 so often linked with preparation or with testing or with trial, and he knows that time of preparation. How will the Lord prepare Elijah for that personal
experience with himself.
Well, I have looked at this in the past, and I have spoken on this chapter in the past, and I have pointed out to believers in the past for their encouragement that you have here in 1 Kings 19 all the features of what we would call depression. And so depression is not something that just happens to people who are unbelievers. It's something that happens to, can happen to anyone, and something that affected and afflicted one of the greatest men of God of the Old Testament. And we recognise that you can go through it, and you can take a tick list here of the very features of depression. Everything from his disturbance of sleep, to his desire to die, to his sense of despair and hopelessness, even to his rejection of food and to the neglect of himself. You've got it all there. It's a textbook case of depression. And so, amongst all of the things that you might feel during a time of depression, you need not feel guilty that you're depressed, because these things happen and can afflict anyone, from those that are total unbelievers to those that have been used in a mighty way by God. But that is not my subject tonight, but you can see that it's there, and it's there just on the surface. I'm thinking about the purpose for which God had this experience in the life of Elijah, and I'm thinking about that goal that God had for Elijah, that he might get him to where he wanted him to be on Mount Horeb, there and ready to listen to the voice of God. You see, how will God get him to that place? How will God get him to that place where he is able to hear and to enjoy the presence of God in a personal, in an intimate, in a fresh way? Well, you'll notice the first thing that God does, or that happens to Elijah, the first thing that happens to him is that he dies. He dies. I think there's not enough death amongst us. If this was a Pentecostal hall, we would be saying there's not enough life amongst us. But before there can be life amongst us, there has to be death amongst us. How we love to embrace the promises of God, and we love to embrace the hope of salvation, and we love to embrace atonement, we love to embrace the promises of heaven. But have you ever died? You say, well, Elijah needed to have that experience, but I don't. I'm a Christian. I'm an ordinary kind of Christian. I'm quite happy with ordinary Christian. Do you know the very first step, the first step in discipleship, and if it has not gripped our heart and touched our life, we have not started on the path of discipleship. Do you remember the threefold definition that the Lord Jesus gives of discipleship? It occurs in three out of the four Gospels. Whosoever shall come after me, let him deny himself, self-denial, take up his cross, self-death, and follow me, self-discipline. A threefold appreciation of what it means to be a disciple. Those are that is the very beginning of discipleship. It's not the end point, it's not the goal. But unless I'm prepared to put myself out of the equation, my desires out of focus, my priorities down at the bottom, non-existent, and put him first and foremost in my life, I will not start to be a disciple. I will never commence to be a disciple. As long as the entertainment of this world still has that grip on me, I have not fully come into the joy of discipleship. As long as the things out there have a pull upon me, as long as Christ gets pushed to the side, I believe it's Manchester United that are playing tonight. I was told that by our Jewish neighbour. He told me he needed to go home from the shop early. I said, why? To remember the Sabbath. He said, no, Manchester United is playing tonight. It had a greater pull on him than his religion. Pity help me if it has a greater pull on me than a real, living experience of Jesus Christ, the very Jehovah that he tells me that belongs to him and that he belongs to. You see, unless
the trivial and transient things of life are trivial and transient unless I am prepared to do whatever he wants me to do at whatever cost he demands of me. Then I've never really started in that path. And so as the Lord would take Elijah to Mount Horeb, the first thing that he experiences is death. Oh, you know, if you had asked Elijah there in verse number 5, that is enough. The question for himself that he might die is enough. If you had asked him, you know, what about all those things in Israel that you've got, Elijah? Cheer up now. Think of the social thing that you've got there. Not interested, is he? Think of the food. Interesting. I think of what people think about you. They all know that you're something remarkable. You're 1 in 450 at least. Doesn't matter to him anymore, does it? He's dead to all of that. He's going on the journey now. And all that matters, or all that will matter in a few verses, is that still small voice of God. The first thing that happens is that he dies, and the second thing that happens is, well, the second thing that happens is that all of his delusion about himself is swept away. He comes to a conclusion that seems to be a significant conclusion for Elijah. Verse number 4, he says, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am not better than my father." I need to watch what I'm saying. I've got a father here. Maybe Elijah thought that he had been better than his father. That seems implied, doesn't it? Maybe he thought that because of all of the things that he had witnessed on Mount Horeb, maybe he thought that because he was a man who was able to control famine by prayer, a man who was able, by the power of God, to raise the dead, a man who was able to call down fire from heaven, maybe he thought that, maybe he had come into that idea that somehow he was better than everybody else. Maybe somehow he thought that because of the things he knew, or the things he had seen, or because of the upbringing he had, or because he was in the right kind of meeting — he wasn't actually in the meeting, but or because of something like that, he was something special. But if he ever had thought that went completely here in this place of preparation, everything as far as his attitude towards himself and towards anything that he might have before me, all of it was swept away because God was going to bring him into a place of total honesty before God. You'll find that Jacob was in that place too. You remember that? Place of total honesty before God. Ever before God could raise up Jacob and make him the man that he wanted him to be, he had to be totally honest with Jacob, with God. Remember how God asked Jacob, "What is your name?" Remember? His old blind father had asked him that many years before. He wasn't like my boys. He had a 50-50 chance of getting the answer right. My boys have a 1 in 5 chance of getting the answer. He had a 50-50 chance of getting the answer right. "What's your name?" And he said, "Esau." Got the wrong answer. So God repeats the question that has been echoing through his mind and his conscience, a lie that he has told. "What's your name, Jacob?" Let's start there. Let's start with all the lies and the deception. "What is your name?" Honest answer. And so God will take Elijah and he'll take everything that doesn't matter, all of the veneer off. Everything that he thinks makes him something, his position in society, his job, his money, his house, his car, what people might think about, takes it all away. And now it's just Elijah and God. Makes you kind of embarrassed in a kind of naked kind of way, doesn't it? everything stripped away, just honesty before God. What a place of preparation that was. And Sam, my boy Sam, said he'll give me a secret signal if I go beyond the time. A secret signal is that. He said nobody would understand apart from me. So I've got 5 minutes before I get the secret signal. Finally, a place of the presence of God. What a place it is. I said, you know, at the beginning that so often in our heart that what we think we need from God and what we think we really need in our life is not at all what we need. And I suppose that maybe, like, I'm just being honest with you now, I suppose like me, maybe you would pray more for the Carmel kind of thing than the Horeb kind of thing. I'm just being honest with you. That we might see the fire, maybe not in judgment, we're told not to pray for that, weren't we, in the New Testament. But that we might see an outpouring of the power of God. There's something appealing about that. Let's confess that there is. We'd love to see it. May the Lord do it in our day. I believe that he can, if we're willing to be used by him. But that's not what Elijah really needed. And God can do that with or without you. You know that, and I know that. But there's another agenda to the whole panacea of biblical revelation and to the whole work of Christ. And it's not just about an outward demonstration of the power of God. It's about a deep personal work in the lives of men and women. God, as you know, has a twofold purpose. His ultimate purpose is for Christ, that Christ might be the head of all things, and all things Christ might have the preeminence. But for you and I, he has a twofold practicable purpose. The first, Ephesians 1, is that of relationship. We are predestined under the adoption of children. He desires not just a manifestation of his power, but he desires those that will have a relationship with him, adopted as children. That is unique in a universe of created beings, that God should adopt children. And secondly, he has the purpose of advancing upon that, Romans 8:29, not only relationship but resemblance, that we might be conformed to the image of his Son. Relationship, and then it follows, doesn't it, resemblance. For he has one unique Son, and having adopted us, he desires that we're like him. And so in that deeper purpose of God, God would desire to take Elijah to this place of his presence. And here are the manifestations of the power of God that perhaps you and I would love to see. But you see how disappointing they can be. Verse 11. Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. After the fire, still, small voice. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering of the cave. And we need to hear today, don't we, the still small voice of God. You do notice that the manifestation of God, the work of God, I should say, the work and the works of God in the earthquake and the works of God in the fire are not the same as the personality of God. You see that there. For those that are interested in religious things, we are not a pantheism. Yeah. Not a pantheism. We distinguish between the creation and the creator. It's not all and one the same thing. But there's a distinction between what God does and who he is, between the things he creates and who he actually is. It's not enough, as somebody in New Pantheism, by the way, is all over New Covenant, but you might remember, you know, so somebody says, you know, I love to get close to God, I go into the hills. No, you love peace and quiet for the life and way, and say, you don't actually love to be close to God, you go into the hills. I have my own church, it's my garden, said another chap. No, it's not. No. Well, sorry, that's pantheism, that's Hinduism, that's Baalism, that's all sorts of things. Not Christianity, it's different.
And so, here we have three manifestations of the power of God, but only one of the presence of God. First and foremost, we must hear it in our own heart and know it in our own daily life. We need to hear it on our platforms as well, don't we? I couldn't help but think that sometimes what maybe we get is the strong wind of verse 11. And in the preaching comes like a mighty strong wind, and we're left with the same effect as we have here in 1 Kings 19. We're left with the debris of broken rocks. And it doesn't actually help us very much. It doesn't actually draw us to Christ. It maybe hammers a particular subgroup of Christians, or it panders to a particular politic, or it maybe encourages a certain line of thinking, but it just leaves us in broken pieces. It doesn't actually draw me closer to the person of Christ. Preaching must always do that, mustn't it? It was one thing and one thing alone that would be of help to Elijah. A still, small voice. What a strange thing for Elijah to learn. Horeb, the place where God had spoken, and either the very mountain or very close to the mountain where God had given the commandments, place that burned with fire and with flame, a place that the Israelites tried to keep away from as far as they could. That was a dangerous place. There was a cordon off round about it. Never mind coming to God, you don't want to go near the mountain. Place where there was the fire and the flame and the lightning and the thunder. And yet that same God is able to understand the needs of my heart, the thoughts and intents of the heart, and you know that I'm plagiarising from the book of Hebrews. He is able to understand the thoughts and intentions of my heart and address my needs personally, practically, sensitively, in a way that nobody else can. That still small voice contained the very word, the very ministry that Elijah needed at that time, wasn't it? He was feeling sorry for himself, amongst other things. And so, as so often happens, sometimes when we feel sorry about ourselves, we get our facts mixed up and our facts observe our feeling of sorriness. And so he's the only one that's remained faithful. Well, actually he isn't. And God has a purpose. God has a sovereign plan. And by the end of it, what seemed a baffling mystery of deep disappointment and despair to Elijah turns into something totally different. And God has appointed his men Jehu and Elisha, and he has 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal, and God will usher in his own time, a time of revival. Sometimes we don't know, don't we not? Well, so we hardly ever know, let's face it. But there in that still small voice, God is able to bring Elijah the very word that he needs to hear. A word that he could never have heard on Mount Carmel, amidst all of the din, and amidst all of the feeling that he had finally made it. But God brings it to him here in the cave. After a period of deep disappointment, he brings it to him there on Mount Horeb, a word even from the Lord himself.